You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 11th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. The Briefing, in association with South Tyrol Tourism. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards.
The strategy of taking out terrorists who threaten us while supporting partners on the front lines is one that we have successfully pursued in Yemen and Somalia for years.
While President Obama lists his supposed successes across the Middle East, we ask how promising his new strategy against IS is. Also coming up in today's programme... Today is La Diada, Catalonia's national day, and almost 500,000 people are expected to fill Barcelona's streets to demand a referendum. We'll have the latest. Plus, we'll review the North American front pages with Daniel Giacopelli. Danny, what's making headlines today?
We'll look at Quebec's advice to Scottish voters. We'll see the best burrito in America, and I'll explain how North Korea is selling itself as a tourism paradise.
More from Daniel with all of that later, and plenty more besides ahead on a busy Thursday edition of The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. Before we start, though, let's get the latest news from all around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. US Secretary of State John Kerry has arrived in Saudi Arabia as America steps up diplomatic efforts to support a broadening of military action against Islamic State militants. Barack Obama announced in a primetime speech on Wednesday that he's authorized US airstrikes in Syria for the first time, as well as an increased campaign in Iraq. But America is looking for countries in the region to increase support militarily and politically. Speaking ahead of talks with key Arab leaders, Mr. Kerry said defeating Islamic State will require a global effort backed by countries in the region.
Many others, particularly in the Muslim world, can join together in defining the real Islam and making it clear that there is no legitimacy whatsoever within ISIL for any of the claims that they make with respect to a religious foundation for their caliphate, their state, or for their actions.
Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of committing war crimes by attacking three UN-run schools in the Gaza Strip in July and August. The New York-based group describes its new report as the first in-depth documentation of the incidents, which took place during a 50-day conflict between Israel and Palestinian militants. The group also said it was skeptical about the credibility of five criminal investigations announced by Israel's military on Wednesday into its Gaza war operations. Human Rights Watch said 45 people, including 17 children, were killed in the attacks. Argentina's Congress has given final approval to a law proposing to restructure the country's debt in order to counter a US court ruling that toppled it into its second default in 12 years. The law enables Argentina to make payments on its foreign-held bonds locally or elsewhere beyond the reaches of the US court. Thai police have arrested five suspects linked to violent clashes 4.5 years ago that left 91 people dead. The authorities say they are believed to be linked to gunmen blamed for triggering the clashes between the army and red shirt demonstrators in April 2010 in Bangkok. The then government said rebels appeared in the crowds of protesters under the cover of darkness and opened fire on troops, triggering chaos and prompting panicked soldiers to fire back in self-defense. Two major British banks, part-owned by the British government, say they would relocate to London if Scotland votes for independence. Britain's political elite have rushed to respond to the prospect of Scottish voters returning a yes vote next week, although the latest poll shows a slender lead to those who want to stay part of the United Kingdom. But Scottish National Party leader Alex Salmond is adamant breaking free is the right thing to do.
Our message to the people of Scotland is this: for the first time in Scottish history, we, the people, hold our destiny in our own hands. We are not going to wake up having given it away again. We shall wake up instead knowing we did the right thing for this, but above all for future generations.
A donation of $50 million by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been welcomed by charities and organisations battling West Africa's Ebola epidemic. The foundation said it would release the funds immediately for supplies and to boost the emergency response in affected countries. The outbreak has already killed almost 2,300 people. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David Spencer. More news from David at the bottom of the hour. Right now it's 5 minutes past midday in London, 7:05 a.m. in New York City. This is The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. This is The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, after US President Obama outlined his military strategy against Islamic State last night, US Secretary of State John Kerry is in Saudi Arabia for further talks with Arab leaders today. The US views Saudi Arabia as a key partner in the coalition against the IS, and the kingdom has so far committed to host training camps for moderate Syrian rebels. So let's discuss this in a little more detail. I'm joined here in studio by Professor Saad Jawad, Iraqi political scientist at the London School of Economics. Professor, welcome to The Briefing. Great to have you with us. I wanted to start just by asking you about one thing that struck me whilst I was listening to what Obama had to say. He talked about this successful pursuit of American strategy in Yemen and Somalia. He held those up as examples of where the job had been done well. Do you think that's aids his case or not?
Well, Mr. Obama is entitled to his own opinion, but I don't think he's right, because the two examples he has given are not really a success. All the ventures of the United States, being in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Yemen, in Syria, in Somalia and Iraq, were all a failure. So I don't think I don't know what how successful he thinks he was or his country was. I mean, what success he was meaning by that, I don't know.
So can I sort of interpret from that then that you're fairly guarded about how optimistic we should be about these latest announcements? I mean, does he reveal anything, do you think, that could actually change the situation on the ground there?
Well, his speech gave us one indication that he doesn't think that the war against ISIS is an easy one. And in my opinion, unless the United States and the West change their strategy in Syria, they will not be successful. I mean, if they keep talking about toppling the regime and fighting ISIS, this is a contradicting objective or objectives, and they cannot do that at the same time. I mean, but in reality, I think there is something else happening. Under the ground, there is some talks between the United States and Syria, even if it was indirectly. And I don't think they cannot do this job without the help of the Syrian regime.
So, I mean, it's interesting. Kerry and Obama have both said that the legitimacy of Assad is gone for good. But you think practicality dictates that there must be some further meeting of minds, if you like, between the two?
Yes, yes. This problem cannot be solved without the coordination of the Syrian regime to start with, and Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Qatar. These three or four elements are very much needed in fighting ISIS. Of course, Iraq, being the Kurdish Peshmerga or the Iraqi armed people or armed forces, they are needed also. But the Iraqi armed forces up till now have proved to be unable to fight this threat. And this is, of course, due to the United States' inability to build a real army in Iraq or a real force in Iraq since 2003, the occupation. They should review their strategy here as well. They haven't supplied the army with any meaningful armaments, no air force, no heavy armaments. What they talk about was only light armaments. But if the West and, of course, some of the Gulf countries keep on talking about arming the resistance to the Syrian government, that means they are going to put more armed people on the ground, contradicting armed people on the ground, and they cannot ensure that they will be fighting ISIS.
Let's consider John Kerry then in Saudi Arabia. He clearly has great hopes that this meeting of some of those other nations you've mentioned can deliver. We know specifically there's this notion that the kingdom could host these training camps for what they describe as moderate Syrian rebels. Again, is this just unhelpful then, reading into what you're saying, or could something fruitful come from Kerry's visit to Saudi and from the contributions of the kingdom potentially?
Well, as I said, you know, ISIS and other fanatic Islamic groups were created by the crisis in Syria, but most important, they were armed and helped and financed by Turkey, West, and some Gulf countries. Unless this source of assistance stops as a first step, they cannot do anything about it. Second, they know very well that the Syrian army proved until now that it is not an easy target, as the Libyan army was, or the Iraqi army was before, or the Yemeni army was. So they have to put this into consideration. I think the mood in the United States and Israel and Turkey and the Gulf country has changed dramatically, especially after the beheading of the two American nationals, journalists the last few weeks. And they have to do something. But to keep on speaking in the same way is not going to help.
Professor Saad Jawad, Iraqi political scientist at the LSE here in London, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on The Briefing. With The Briefing here in London, 12:12. Now, it's not just in Scotland today where self-determination is dominating the political agenda. 500,000 people are expected to gather on the streets of Barcelona, not only to mark a Catalan National Day, but also to demand the right to hold a vote on secession. The Catalan government has called for a referendum in November. Madrid, of course, continues to insist that the vote is illegal. Well, joining us on the line from Barcelona is Alejandro Arribo, lecturer in political science at the Universitat Obert de Catalunya. Alejandro, thank you very much indeed for joining us. I wanted to ask you first about the mood throughout Catalunya as a result of what we're seeing here in the UK, this increasing momentum behind the Scottish independence campaign. Is that galvanising people in Barcelona and throughout Catalonia, do you think?
Well, there is a link between the Scottish referendum and the 9 November here, the referendum that we're going to have here in Barcelona. And obviously, there are similarities, also many differences. One of the similarities, the biggest similarity, is that the path of democracy and peaceful process for independence. And that's exactly what we are defending here in Barcelona. So we feel very encouraged by a process that is very successful on being peaceful and democratic, and we are following the same way.
Well, tell us then about the prospects of this 9th of November vote, because Madrid seems fairly intransigent about it. Do you think that's a kind of gentle, easy democracy that you're describing will come to pass? Will we see a vote that satisfies both sides?
So that's what we are expecting, that we're going to have a vote that expresses the wishes of the majority of the people, the Catalan people majority, the Catalan people wishes for deciding their own future. What Madrid is saying is that it's actually fairly legal, but we don't think it's an illegal vote. It's just a democratic vote.
Well, tell us then, if that frustration does spread indeed to the streets and we see these kind of protests, what are they going to look like today? How many people are we talking about? And will the mood be quite controlled and considered and stressing these democratic principles? Or could it get slightly more, I don't know, antagonistic than that?
Well, the organisers, they also organised the last two demonstrations on 9/11, that's the National Day of Catalonia. And there were 1.2 million people in 2012, 1.6 million people in 2013, that it was a big human chain from north to south, 400 kilometers. And in the last year, there were registrations for 400,000 people because they have to register it online. This year, we have a registration for more than 500,000 people registered online. So we are expecting, I would say, much more than that figure. Last year was completely peaceful, not one single accident of violence in Catalonia, and we are expecting the same.
Alejandro, just tell me, what's your reading then of this sort of wider mood throughout Europe then of secessionist questions, notions of self-determination? Because people are already speculating that almost regardless of the vote, the outcome of the vote in Scotland next week, there'll be more pressure here in the UK. You know, will the other former parts of the United Kingdom be asking these same questions? Will we see the mood shifting further in, also in other parts of Spain, in the Basque country, for example, or elsewhere in Europe? Do you think we could be looking at a bit of a tidal change throughout all of the continent of Europe?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the key word here is democracy. When the people have the way to express their will and express their wishes for the future, I think it's always positive if they do it in a very organized, peaceful way. And this is the key for us in Catalonia. The process has to be democratic and peaceful. And if any other part in Europe that happens the same and is justified by a majority of people that want to govern themselves, I think we might see a tide of different communities in Europe that want to be independent. They might be less or more successful according to the support they have. But that's what democracy is about.
Alejandro Ribó, speaking to us from Barcelona. Thank you very much for sharing your insights here on The Briefing. And we'll have more on the Scotland yes-no vote a little later in the programme. You're listening to The Briefing. Up next, we'll ask if post-coup the Thai authorities have managed to win hearts and minds. Stay with us.
South Tyrol has always done things its own way. With its unique setting in northern Italy, the region's high mountains and fertile valleys, architecture and delicious food have developed a distinctive flavour. From its fresh pistes to the spas and piazzas of its picturesque cities, South Tyrol is a gateway to Middle Europa. South Tyrol, a world of its own.
This is The Briefing on Monocle 24, 12:17 here in London. Now, Thai leader Yingluck Shinawatra was ousted in a bloodless coup in May, orchestrated by military leader Prayuth Chan-o-cha. General Prayuth is now winning over some Thais and a number of Western expats by cracking down on corruption, organised crime and illegal business. The junta claims it restored stability following months of public protest. Well, let's assess the validity of those claims by speaking to Gwen Robinson, correspondent and senior fellow at the Institute of Security and International Studies at Chulalongkorn University in Thailand. Gwen, great to speak with you as always. This has been some interesting sort of pieces we've been reading about this notion, particularly expats who are suggesting that they rather like the post-coup landscape. Does that sort of view hold much weight where you are?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the first thing one should say, though, is that I think the old divisions that caused the problem in the first place and the tremendous political divide we've seen open up in Thailand over the last year remains. So you can assume that there are a lot out there who aren't sort of exactly pouring love and affection on the junta or the junta-installed government. However, what is, I think, quite surprising is how much what you might call the middle ground has embraced the new regime. Business loves the coup. There is no doubt. I've not spoken to one business person who has any complaints. That's basically, I think, largely on a pragmatic rather than ideological basis. It's not that they like men in green running their running the country, but it's just that, you know, suddenly overnight, a lot of blockages were cleared up, projects were being approved, things started moving, bureaucracy was being cleaned up, red tape is cut, they cracked down on corruption in all kinds of ways, ranging from taxis and motorcycle boys in the streets to bus services, and then higher up, you know, really serious things like the administration of big state-owned enterprises and so on and so on. So you've got a whole range of reforms that largely appeal to this middle class and urban professional. At the same time, they've been smart enough, the generals, to quickly put in place payoffs to the farmers who were left unpaid over this controversial rice subsidy scheme that was run under the previous Yingluck government. So the farmers who might have been unhappy became very happy very quickly. And as I'm sure all the listeners have maybe heard, the junta did launch this rather absurd series of happiness festivals and happiness campaigns around the country. That shouldn't be underestimated. You know, poor people like these things. They go along, they sing the songs, they get free haircuts and food. So you can, up to extent, buy a little laugh. But I think the junta does mean business on cleaning up the government's act.
Interesting that they mean business. Some dissenting voices, though, amongst others from Amnesty International, they've released a statement today, a new report suggesting that the military government has engaged in what they term widespread human rights violations. They look at people who are being held on vague and flimsy grounds. You mentioned there the appetite, particularly amongst business people, to just get on with things, and they're seeing progress and they maybe don't ask some of these ethical questions. There must be a note of caution, though. Presumably there are a lot of people, dissenting voices, who are saying, well, look, you know, what price do you put on this sort of progress? The details as listed in this Amnesty report are surely of grave concern.
Yes, I think the truth is somewhere in between, and you're absolutely right, and it's a very, very valid point. But what we're seeing is, I think, beyond, if you're not a businessman in a suit or an urban middle-class professional or university student, perhaps more, we're talking about intellectuals, dissenters, people who would criticise the junta, mainly for seizing power in an undemocratic way. These are the people who are feeling the fear. I've just checked on numbers who are supposedly either under arrest or facing charges of either lese majeste, which is any criticism of the king. That's always been in place, but there's been a slight ratcheting up of crackdowns on dissent of that sort. There are people being held. It's impossible to get the accurate numbers, but what Amnesty might characterise as widespread human rights abuses is not kicking through in popular media here. You're definitely, though, seeing references to, you know, some sort of implicit intimidation, really. Like, people are scared to speak out. The junta's shown itself to be very sensitive to criticism. It tried to bring in some absurd curbs on media, including things like making it illegal for media to write anything critical about the junta, which of course is absurd and hasn't lasted. And I do notice, though, that the ever active Thai press is managing to get some fair criticism into some of the coverage. So it's not all, we're not talking about North Korea here. There is an appearance, anyway, that things are relaxing a little bit more, getting back to normal. However, as you point out, if you are an academic who wants to take a swipe, you'd better be careful. And, you know, one of the big cases was the cancellation of the passport of a Thai academic who's actually at a Japanese university. And overnight, he suddenly had his passport cancelled because he's been very critical and outspoken. Mm. And that, you know, was an extreme act. But again, I'd say that that's a fairly limited and extreme action on the part of the junta.
Gwen, I just want to ask you very, very briefly one final thought. There was talk even of elections taking place as early as next year. Lots of commitment to the sort of economic growth, these encouraging percentage point figures that you mentioned at the top. Just in short, will we see elections next year? Is that much too soon? And if not, what will we see? Just a kind of continuation of the situation as it is now, not too many drastic changes ahead? What's your best guess?
Well, that's a really good question too, and I think there's already signs. When General Prayut first took power, and in certain utterings of the junta, we've had vague pledges to have elections within, you know, next year. But actually, that has slid lately, and everybody I talk to seems to, it's slowly morphing into an acceptance that this timetable may slide into 2016. So, you know, it is likely that that will be put off. What the junta's putting in place now is quite an onerous system, an appointed National Assembly. They're just about to come out with a reform council that's supposed to implement or oversee constitutional reforms and various other broad areas of reform. And that's all going to take time, really a lot of time. They want to amend or change more than 250 laws first up. There'll be more in place. They're going to dismantle certain ministries, set up new ones, basically revamp, reform bureaucracy and laws. That cannot be done within a year. But they're still, you know, you still hear this. But I think deep down, most people really are not expecting elections until 2016. And might I say finally that the wild card really in all this is the king, the monarch, who's greatly revered and is in very ill health and very frail. You know, everything could change overnight. We'll have issues of succession, but I better not talk too much about that unless I end up in jail.
Absolutely. You need to look after yourself, Gwen. That's our Gwen Robinson talking to us from Bangkok. Gwen, thanks for joining us here on The Briefing. It's 25 minutes past midday here in London. That means it's 7:25 a.m. in Washington, D.C. That means it's time to look through some North American newspapers. Here with a clutch of papers in his hand, there's the sound. It's Daniel Giacopelli. Daniel, welcome to The Briefing. Good to speak with you as always. Where should we start? The National Post, I see you have before you.
The National Post, indeed. They have kind of a funny article here about Quebec separatists, and they're kind of doling out advice to the Scots. They're basically saying, don't vote no, because we became laughing stocks when we voted no. You know, all these people promised concessions prior to the vote, and they kind of bought it, you know, hook, line, and sinker, and now they're saying, you know, we regret that. You shouldn't do that. You should vote yes.
It's interesting. We were talking to one of our many experts just a moment or two ago about the appetite for change in Catalonia and Spain. Could it spread to the Basque Country? Of course, got Scotland. Whichever way the vote goes in Scotland, one senses that the rest of the UK might say, well, hang on, we'd like some more devolved powers. It's interesting how it does seem to, you know, pique people's interest all around the world. Who'll be next? What about in the US, Danny? I know we talk about state secessions at times.
Well,
anyone
right.
else on the list?
I mean, yeah, this article in the New York Times, I don't know if that's the one you're referencing. I mean, it says, from Kurdistan to Texas, Scots spur separatists. Kind of a tongue twister there. But basically, well, they are making the argument that it could be a bit of a domino effect. I mean, you know, it's not really new secessionist movements at all. I mean, it goes back centuries. But yeah, in particular in the U.S., there's tons of states, portions of states, I should say, that always do want to secede. California has an interesting proposal from famous venture capitalist Tim Draper, who proposes to split it up into, I think, five different sections, which of course...
I don't know if he thought that one through.
No, it'll never happen.
Okay, where should we
go? And actually, it'll never happen because nobody wants, you know, the number of representatives to double overnight or, you know, quadruple overnight.
Okay. Well, it's always that fraught relationship then with the central government, especially in the federal system. Where should we head next?
San Francisco Chronicle. It says Mission Classic wraps up title as best burrito in the country.
Tell me more about this, Danny. I like a burrito.
Well, basically, it's just a burrito story.
Simple. One of the old classics.
La Taqueria in San Francisco. They've won some sort of competition. They're the best. It looks pretty good. Doesn't look any better than, you know, things you can necessarily not get.
So that's
over
what's
here in
pictured
London.
There. We've got a Carnitas Super Burrito.
Yeah, a La Taqueria.
Do we know what makes it so super?
No, it looks like there's some guacamole, though. Yes. Which, of course, comes extra.
Is it? It might be included. You don't know that for sure, do you?
Shall we move on to the Washington Post?
I was going to talk more about burritos, but you can if you want.
North Korea is selling itself as a vacation destination. In search of tourism, this is the Washington Post, they say, in search of tourism revenue, a regime tries to lure the adventurous. Have you ever been to North Korea?
I haven't. It has struck me once or twice. They have the a Pyongyang marathon that takes place, Danny, and they've in the last couple of years, they've opened that up to Western athletes like myself to take part. That's one I thought might be quite interesting.
Yeah,
I do worry it would be rather too stage managed, though. Maybe you wouldn't see the
maybe
true
just a bit.
North Korea.
Yeah, I think
from what I gather,
you probably run next to a minder or something.
I think that is what happens. What about you, Don Giacopelli? Would you?
I would love to
break
go.
Into the Giacopelli millions to finance a trip to North Korea.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, obviously, there's a whole ethical aspect of it too. You know, supporting a tyrannical regime, yet how could he open up a country without ever visiting it? So it's kind of this quandary that people face. But I think visiting countries is probably always better than not visiting them in terms of, you know.
It's true. Open up the borders. Do we know what are these adventures you can have there? Is it adventure holidays or is it just adventurous simply to actually head for the country per se at all?
Yeah, it says a growing number of Western tourists called Europeans in North Korea, even though more and more include Americans. Basically, they're going there for political tourism and just you know,
to have a look. Well, there's that big pyramid hotel that's still empty, isn't it?
Exactly.
I'd like to go and check that out. Danny, we've probably got time for one more. Have you got?
Well, just I'd just like to quickly point out the Boston Globe. They have a quirky article here about program vendors at sporting events at, you know, baseball, Fenway Park. And it's just kind of the war between the various competing factions selling merch. And it's kind of funny. One group calls themselves the Yawkey Militia.
I like this. So this guy, he was selling Boston baseball. He was fired and created his own one, the Yawkey Way Report.
Yeah.
Look at him. He's bellowing out there selling it.
Yeah, he is.
I would buy a program.
A warrior yell.
I like it. Battle cry of the program vendors.
There we are.
Daniel Giacopelli, thanks for running through the newspapers for us today. That was Daniel Giacopelli. We'll probably be hearing from him again some point next week, maybe leafing through the newspapers. You're listening to The Briefing. There's plenty still ahead in today's programme. Business headlines from our friends at Bloomberg, amongst others. We'll be hearing more, as I said earlier, about the Scottish independence vote. And we'll discuss a music festival here in London, where a leading role is played by drones. That's right. We'll explain it all later. First, let's get the latest news headlines. Here's David Spencer.
Thank you very much indeed. US Secretary of State John Kerry is pressing Arab leaders to support American plans for a new military campaign against Islamic State militants. Barack Obama's confirmed more airstrikes in Iraq against the group will be approved, while also giving the green light to airstrikes against the militants in Syria. Rescuers from India and Pakistan have begun evacuating thousands of people stranded by severe flooding in Kashmir. At least 450 people have been killed after the heaviest rainfall in 50 years in the heavily militarised and disputed region. There are reports that the Al-Qaeda-backed Nusra Front group has released the UN peacekeepers it seized 2 weeks ago on the Golan Heights. On Wednesday, the head of Fiji's army said the Islamist militant group had dropped all of its demands to free the 45 hostages. Hundreds of thousands of Catalans are expected on the streets of Barcelona to demand the right to vote on a split from Spain later. The Catalan regional governments called a referendum on November the 9th over whether to separate, but the Madrid government says the vote is illegal. The Philippines has stepped up its bid to prove that China's territorial claims over the South China Sea should not include a disputed shoal. Officials in Manila have put on display dozens of ancient maps, which they say prove their claims. Those are latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David Spencer. More news from David at the top of the hour. A full bulletin coming away at 1300 hours London time right here on Monocle 24. 12:32 though in London right now. Time to talk business. I'm delighted to welcome from Bloomberg TV Naira Chaich to the show. Naira, good to catch up with you as always. You've got some late breaking news for us. Sanctions and Russia. What's the EU up to next? I gather we've learned a little bit more in the last half hour.
Yeah, exactly. In the past hour, Tom, because really what happened is that the EU actually voted for additional sanctions on Russia on September 5th. They've delayed actually implementing them until now. I'll tell you why in a sec. First, just to let you know that the EU has said these sanctions against Russia will be enacted tomorrow. That's according to three EU officials. EU governments have actually agreed on sanctions to bar some Russian state-owned defence and energy companies from raising capital in the EU. That's according to those officials. Now, the reason that we've sort of had this delay over the past couple of days is that some EU countries had argued that going ahead with the restrictions, with the sanctions now, would really provoke the Kremlin to sort of retaliate, as it has done already, you know, with the import bans that we've already seen on the part of Russia. And the reason they didn't want to do that is because, of course, there's a ceasefire at the moment in eastern Ukraine, and they didn't want to give the Kremlin a pretext to actually bring that to an end or do anything else in retaliation. So that's why we've had that delay, why they won't be enacted until tomorrow. And what's more, we're going to get an EU statement later today, which will spell out what Russia needs to do to actually get the sanctions lifted, because obviously the idea is not to have them in place forever.
Indeed. Now let's move on and talk a little bit about Scotland. The independence debate is raging. Interesting though, we've seen last night and then confirmed this morning in a lot of official announcement that businesses they're being slightly more decisive than all of those other don't knows who are still up there in Scotland, aren't they?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, at the moment, the latest poll has shown that the no vote is actually in the lead, you know, following that poll in the weekend, which caused the most concern, showing the yes vote ahead for the first time this year. So really, it shows that even at this point, it's not a done deal either way. There's a lot of uncertainty, and that uncertainty is getting to business leaders. So what we've heard is that Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds, they're the two biggest lenders in Scotland, by the way, you know, they've talked about contingency plans. Lloyds has said it has a contingency plan for establishing new legal entities in England in the event of a yes vote. RBS has said a yes vote would make it necessary to re-domicile its headquarters. So, you know, we've been sort of hearing a little bit about what could be called a sort of financial exodus. Some analysts say that the risk now has actually become irreversible, meaning that the issue of independence could rear its head again in the future. So banks might just decide to move, whatever the outcome. And, you know, banks' confidence has also probably not been helped by Bank of England Governor Mark Carney saying that a Scottish central bank without control of the sterling currency wouldn't be a credible lender of last resort, meaning that banks based in Scotland could fail taking depositors' money with them. So there really is enough there to cause concern.
And Naira, what about concerns elsewhere? Is it just in the banking sector, or is it more widespread in your view?
It's more widespread. So Kingfisher's CEO has come out and urged voters not to make a mistake in a once-in-a-lifetime decision, arguing that independence would mean higher prices and lower investment. BP's CEO, Bob Dudley, has said that BP considers the future prospects, I'm quoting him now, for the North Sea are best served by maintaining the existing capacity and integrity of the United Kingdom. And there's even more businesses kind of ditching neutrality and either speaking out against independence or just saying that they're making contingency plans. And among them, you've got oil company, another one, Royal Dutch Shell, and also Standard Life Financial Services Company. There are still some companies, though, who are sitting on the fence or at least saying that they're not going to get involved in the politics. And one of those is Tesco.
Well, that's talking about potential secession. Let's talk about banking succession next up, Naira. See what I've done there? It's very clever, isn't it?
Yeah, very clever.
Annabot in Santander, of course, the demise of the patriarch of this sort of banking dynasty. What's everyone making of this?
Yeah, so obviously, as we know, sadly, 2 days ago, former chairman Emilio Botín, chairman of Santander, he passed away of a heart attack, age 79. And late last night, Santander's board named his daughter, Ana Botín, to the post. Now, in succeeding her father as chairman of Santander, Ana Botín has become the most powerful woman in European banking. You know, it really wasn't a surprising decision. Her name was on the lips of pretty much everyone as the most likely successor to her father. She'll give up her role as CEO of Santander's UK business, that's her current role, to take on the top job at what is Europe's second biggest bank by market value currently. So as I say, her appointment wasn't a surprise. Why? Well, she has been at Santander for 26 years. She led acquisitions in Latin America in the 1990s and ran the Banesto Spanish retail unit before becoming CEO of Santander's UK unit in 2010. And it's actually the UK unit that's been driving the bank's return to earnings growth, while Santander's home market of Spain has actually been trying to come out of an economic slump. So Botín's certainly got the professional credentials, but of course she's also got the lineage because she's part of this banking dynasty which owns 2% of Santander and has helped run it since at least 1895.
I just wonder then, Naira, as you described, I mean, she clearly has the sort of financial credentials. But what about that responsibility? Is it an advantage to her to come from that stock, or is it could it be, you know, difficult to sort of justify it because people will have such expectations that, you know, maybe that they would suggest that she should be able to fill the boots of her father?
Well, yeah, that's a really good point because she definitely has big shoes to fill. I mean, firstly, there were some concerns ahead of the appointment, you know, about corporate governance, you know, the fact that the role was just passed down to his daughter. But obviously, the board did actually vote unanimously for her. So clearly that wasn't a concern for them. And as I say, you know, she does have big shoes to fill because Emilio Botín, he started as chairman at Santander in 1986. You know, the bank used to be just a regional lender in Spain, and he built it up from that into a big global player with markets in the UK, in the US, in Brazil, in Germany, as I said before, Europe's second biggest bank by market value. And guess what? It has assets which are about the size of Spain's economy. I mean, that is quite staggering. So he's really taken the bank a very long way. He's been sort of a mentor and guider to a lot of current CEOs of big global banks. So she does have big shoes to fill. But on the other hand, you could argue, well, she certainly had the best example to do it, you know, being the daughter of Emilio Botín. And she's 53 at the moment. So she's been at the bank 26 years. You know, let's say she stays in the role till the age of 79. She's still got those 26 years ahead of her to do a lot. So she's got time. She's got the background. She's got the credentials. But yes, it is a big task, and there are a lot of expectations for her to fulfil.
Well, we'll watch with interest to see how she fares. Neira Church from Bloomberg TV, thanks very much for joining us here on The Briefing. You're listening to Monocle 24. Up next, we will be talking media. Stay tuned.
South Tyrol has always done things its own way. Nestled in Italy's mountainous north, the region enjoys over 300 days of sunshine and year-round skiing in the Dolomites World Heritage Mountain Range. Its lofty peaks and green valleys are also fertile ground for a new crop of entrepreneurs, making a name for the region in everything from food to hospitality. South Tyrol, a world of its own.
It's exactly 12:41 here in London, 8:41 in Sao Paulo. Time to round up the big media stories of the week for you next on The Briefing. Joining me today is Arian McNichol of The Week magazine here in the UK. Arian, great to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Not at all.
Let's start by talking a little bit about, it's web service provision. Now, maybe some people would say, that doesn't sound that inspiring, but this is a really big and significant story. Perhaps you can explain to us exactly why.
It is, yeah. Even the words themselves, net neutrality, sound fairly dry and boring, but the reality is that it's a story that's going to potentially affect us all. And many people would have heard about it because yesterday, three of the biggest web services in the world, Netflix, Reddit, and Twitter, led a protest against this new proposal by the Federal Communications Commission, which is effectively going to create, they say, a two-tier system for the internet, where effectively you get a faster tier for any web services that are willing to pay and a slower tier for anyone who isn't. And what they say is that this fundamentally damages the idea that's central to the internet, that we all have free access to all data. The idea of the open web is that we're all given free access to any piece of data in exactly equal measure. So it is a big deal, and the problem is that they say that the FCC is acting on behalf of these major players, the cable providers themselves. So it's hard to know where this will go exactly, but certainly with the likes of Google and the services that took part yesterday, it looks like there's real wind in the sails of the protest movement, but it just remains to be seen whether we are left with the internet that we have come to know.
Indeed. Well, we'll watch that very carefully. Let's talk a little bit about something that, well, practically nobody could avoid the other day. This is one of Apple's fabled new launch days. One interesting aside that you've picked up on is this idea about the value or lack of value we place on music. U2, of course, gave away their album on the day to everybody.
That's
all
right.
The subscribers. I think it's some, I don't know, half a billion people.
Exactly.
What do you make of this?
500 million people all had this new album pushed to them simultaneously, which makes it one of the biggest album launches of all time in U2's favour. So they'll be pretty happy about this. But there is some concern, and you know, people are worried that, A, it sets a precedent for music being given away, which means that, you know, that we're fundamentally questioning what music is worth. You know, a couple of years ago, Radiohead gave away their In Rainbows album and allowed people to to pay what they wanted for it. Frank Ocean's done a similar sort of thing. De La Soul gave away some music this year, but it does raise that question. But I think secondarily, there's another big issue that's been raised here, which is, if Apple can push an album to us, what else can they push to us? And I think people are concerned that this opens the floodgates to all sorts of potential pushes, not only an album that they may or may not want.
somebody did make a very good point to me, which was that with the recent criticism about people looking after their, you know, their personal material that was in the cloud, maybe by installing an unwanted U2 album, it would force people to go and delete material they didn't want. And actually, it was a clever way of making people, reminding them that they should, you know, purge their cloud of unwanted material.
So maybe it's a good
thing. I don't know if Bono and his friends would be that into that idea. But anyway, let's move on and talk a little bit about a figure in, well, it's kind of US political scene who people will have recognised, who's now sort of, you know, diversifying slightly. And tell us what Jay Carney's been up to.
So Jay Carney for 3 years has been the White House spokesman. So he'll be the person who's standing up in front of rabid reporters who have difficult questions
for the
president.
I'm sure they're very well-balanced reporters.
I'm sure some of them, maybe. But so he's been taking the heat from all quarters on behalf of the president. But he has just stepped down and he has a new role as the political editor for or a political analyst for CNN, and last night he took on his first big project, speaking to Obama's prime time announcement of his new policies in relation to the Islamic State. And he got thoroughly mauled by John McCain, who had a go at him. And I think this will be a problem for Jay Carney, trying to switch from being a White House spokesman to being a pundit. It's not going to be an easy ride because, you know, all manner of people, not only those from the Republican spectrum, see him as having been this mouthpiece for the president. So it's going to be a tricky task, you feel.
It'll make interesting viewing, though.
Certainly
without
will.
Any question. Arian McNichol of The Week magazine, thanks very much for joining us here on The Briefing. You're listening to Monocle 24. It is 14:46 in Cairo, 12:46 in London, and 7:46 in Washington, D.C. It's time next for this week's series. In exactly 1 week's time, voters in Scotland will be asked to answer one, what you would think, very simple question. Should Scotland be an independent country? But is this a conversation about government, politics, and the democratic process? Or a question about Scotland's very national identity? Few referenda of this kind, where nationalism and national identity have been called into question, have been conducted in an atmosphere of peace and within such a rigid democratic framework. Monocle's Thomas Lewis reports now on where the idea of Scotland itself fits into the campaign for and against Scottish independence.
It's a Friday evening in Edinburgh, and in the dimly lit upper room of the Waverley pub just off the historic Royal Mile, I've come to a monthly meeting of the city's storytellers, who are telling tales of Scotland's past and who are looking ahead to Scotland's future.
But every one of those children were taught a trade, just in case.
Storytelling is just very deep. It's connected to who we are, it's connected to where we've been, our ancestors. I think it's a very, very human way of being, you know, feeling that you belong, having a story, passing it on.
Janice McKay is a children's author who's come along to the Waverley pub this evening to tell a story. The narrative currently being spun in the debate on Scotland's independence across the country has energised large swathes of the nation, she says.
I think it's really exciting. I kind of feel Scotland is an independent country. And, you know, we are such a fantastic country. There's some amazing people like you and me and all kind of people who are coming up with this incredible stuff. So you can't stop that. You know, you can't stop that kind of energy. It feels like the French Revolution.
Well, revolution or not, on the 18th of September, the debate has asked several questions of those who live and work in Scotland, questions very few nations around the world are ever expected to answer.
In Scotland today, there's still a great energy of local sense of community that's expressed through stories and storytelling.
Donald Smith is the founder of the Scotland International Storytelling Festival, which takes place every autumn.
It's a way in which people can communicate, can get together, can listen to each other, can share experiences and generate a bit of common sense of identity and perhaps of energy around some aspect of social or community or environmental or indeed political change.
And that common sense of political change has never been as present as it is in Scotland now. Independence isn't a single question with a single answer, however. The economy, education, public transport, and ultimately the kind of society Scotland would like to be have all been the topics of debate up and down the country. And with that, explicitly or not, has come a question of Scotland's collective identity too.
This isn't about ethnicity, accent, birthplace or anything. This is about the people, the 5.3 million people that happen to live in that territory called Scotland.
Marco Biaggi is a member of the Scottish Parliament for the Scottish National Party.
The identity angle is very strange because a lot of people from around the world came to Scotland when the White Paper was launched expecting tartan-clad, painted-face brave hearts, and instead they got a row of people in suits putting forward a technocratic vision of a Scandinavian social democratic paradise.
The kind of nationalism that the SNP now is espousing is a very, what they call, civic nationalism.
Muir Dickey is Scotland correspondent for the Financial Times.
The line that the SNP constantly gives is, who better to govern Scotland than the people who live and work here? It's not the Scots. And when coming to define the Scots anyway, their definition is very much people who have chosen to be here.
I think that there's an element of disingenuousness on the part of those who say that this is not about identity.
Martin McGregor is a senior lecturer at the School of Scottish History at Glasgow University.
I think from an historian's point of view, it's very hard to escape those questions of identity. One of the successes of the UK, of the British state as it came into being then, was to create a kind of Scoto-British identity, if you like, that Scots felt that the Union did still enable the survival of that Scottish identity, that it did, that its purpose was not to erase that.
It's a sentiment that the Better Together campaign, who are campaigning for a no vote in the referendum, has attempted to emphasise in the closing stages of the campaign as the yes vote has gained ground.
You're not deciding that Scotland's a nation, we are. You're not deciding whether to have a parliament or not, we have it. You're not deciding on extra powers, we've got them. What you're deciding on is whether you want, after all these years, to break every single link with the rest of the United Kingdom.
The fireworks light up the sky above Edinburgh as the city's annual festival comes to a close. Scotland's identity has played a part in this debate and will in the years following the day of the vote, whatever the result. But the quiet, subtle way in which it's played its part so far, at least, has, for many, been the most refreshing feature of the independence discussion. The actress Gabrielle Quigley explains.
It's a very positive time. I mean, for all, there's a lot of fears. There's a lot of hopes as well. And it's very rare you hear people talking about what they want their country to be. You know, it's been so apathetic for so long and kind of hopeless. So this has created a big surge, albeit a lot of fighting, but that's a good thing. Yes, I have made my mind up, yes. I think you can probably gather what it is.
For Monocle, in Edinburgh, I'm Thomas Lewis.
And you'll be able to hear the final part of Thomas's series tomorrow right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Nothing compares to a handmade wooden yacht, so say Bodrum's boat builders. Monocle travels to the Turkish port city to film the century-old skills still at the heart of the country's boat-making business.
The wooden bullets, they have soul. I don't want to say the other ones don't have any soul, but it's different. We fall in love with the wooden boats and we give our soul when we build the boats. It's like an art. Every small piece done by hand.
Boat Builders of Bodrum, a cinematic portrait, now playing on monocle.com.
You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24, ticking towards 12:54 here in London. We move now to drones, unmanned aerial vehicles usually associated with asymmetrical warfare. But this Friday and Saturday, the Barbican Centre in London will showcase a musical and technical project with drones as a central part of the act, hovering over the audience in the form of a drone orchestra. Oh, yes. Let's discuss this in more detail. I'm joined now by Chris Sharp, contemporary music programmer at the Barbican. Chris, great to speak with you. Thanks for coming to see us.
Very welcome. Tell
me about this drone orchestra. This is one of these ideas. Where does an idea like that begin?
That is an extremely good question. Where does any idea begin? Usually it's when you take a meeting with somebody, you know, and one thing leads to another. I think this is the classic, or the all-time classic, one thing leading to another type conversation. This is a project that had been kind of slightly in development for a while. I think the two protagonists, Liam Young, who's the drone genius, and John Cale, the musician, had already been talking to one another. I was introduced to Liam by a kind of mutual acquaintance, and I kind of like taking meetings with people, especially when they sound interesting. So I took a meeting with Liam and we had a cup of coffee, and he told me about the project. And it was immediately one of those things where you kind of thought, well, actually, I simply don't believe this could happen. So in a sort of agent provocateur sort of way, I said, well, Liam, you know, if I was to say to you, we want to do this, you know, what would you do? And his kind of eyes were open a little bit more wide than they were previously. And he said, well, I'd get on the phone to John. So I really said, get on the phone to John.
Let's get on with it.
And I simplify things, of course, but we get approached with ideas all the time. And every once in a while, ones come along that tick a lot of boxes. And this one did, including, you know, my penchant for making life difficult for myself.
Right, exactly. That's always an important part of the creative process. Now, you've worked with lots of sort of a huge range of incredible characters through your work, you know, Philip Glass, Aphex Twin, and there must be always these different sort of delights and, I don't know, maybe challenges on occasion. Tell me about the specifics then of this particular project. You mentioned making your life difficult. Did you feel you'd even raised the bar on anything you'd undertaken before this time?
Yes. I was having a conversation with a colleague this morning, actually, and he said, where does this fit in? And I definitely think it's a top five all-time stupid, and it's probably a top three all-time stupid, actually. And we'll find out after the weekend whether it actually has hit the top spot. I mean, really, in essence, it's simple because it's a concert made complicated by the fact that we've got stuff flying around in the auditorium. The musical side of it is innovative, but not technically incredibly demanding. Part of what we're doing is we're routing audio signals from the band onto speakers that are mounted on the drones. So they'll create a kind of, well, you know, Liam and John conceive of them as additional members of the band, really, in that, you know, there'll be musical material that the drones will broadcast from their moving position in the auditorium.
It's fascinating. I don't know. I think we've got a little clip. Well, let's see if we can take a listen. This might give some sense. You'll have to correct me if I'm wrong about this, but let's take a listen and see what we've got. Now, that certainly had I don't know what to call that, brooding, a sort of air of menace. Is that part of it? Is it a bit of a commentary on drones and what they do, this sort of this darker side to it?
It's actually an attempt to subvert that. I mean, I think what that clip gave us there was a kind of idea of some of the, you will hear, as well as the musical sounds that the drones are carrying around, you will hear the drone's own sound being kind of fed back into the performance. So some of the drones have mics mounted on them and they'll be processed and then fed into the kind of overall sound mix. So some of what you just heard is indicative of that kind of audio experience that you'll have in the audience. But equally, a large part of what we're trying to do is to really subvert ideas around the kind of surveillance and military associations that these things have. Liam's very keen to bring to people's attention that the drones are going to be very widespread and possibly sooner than we think. You know, everyone knows that, you know, Amazon wants to deliver things, people want to deliver pizza with drones, all this kind of stuff. You know, when the various regulatory challenges are overcome, the technology is already there.
So the idea, I guess, it could be something creative and a force perhaps for good as well as bad.
Well, certainly for kind of surprise and delight. And one of the things that Liam's worked really hard on is how the drone's appearance, when you see them, they're in costume. They will have character.
We'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid, Chris, but people will be able to see them this weekend at the Barbican. That's Chris Sharp, contemporary music programmer at the Barbican. Chris, terrific stuff. Thanks for coming to see us on The Briefing. That's all we've got time for on this edition. My thanks to our producer, Isabel Kayser, and our researchers, Gaia Lutz and Rebecca Unger, and our studio manager, Bill Lutie. Goodbye.
From London
to New York.
Nach Berlin.
Dao Shanghai.
Ob Zürich.
Am Moskau.
To Sao Paulo.
All around the world.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.